Protection Board, in its last decision, agreed that I had a reasonable belief of wrongdoing occurring, but also the TSA. When I made my...
We have four seconds.
That's all I can say.
But thank you very much. A very important case. Robert McLean and Neil Katyal. That does it for our show. We're headed to Sundance for the film festival. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. It's our auto show special, and we have a special guest who's calling in right now to be on the air with us, so hang on. Hi, this is WHFR Radio, Jay speaking. Hi, great. We're going to put you on right now, so just hang on. And here is our special guest on the phone with us, Eddie Alderman of Car and Driver Magazine. Thank you for calling in today.
Sure. How you doing, Jay?
Just fine. I know we talked a couple of years ago, always trying to get a very distinguished automobile critic on the shows, and we try not to play favorites too much, although I have to admit Car and Driver is my favorite magazine about cars, so... There's the plug, but Mr. Alderman here, folks, he is the editor-in-chief. That's very distinguished. Does that mean you're in charge of other editors?
Yeah, absolutely. It's great. I get to yell at everybody. It's fantastic. I highly recommend it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking, I have been in education and teaching at the college level for more than 40 years now, and with the radio station here at the college for... this is our 30th year, in fact. So that's all been fun, very exciting. But I thought the number two job that I would find extremely exciting is to be a writer and car tester for one of the automotive magazines here in the U.S. That's you know, I mean, there's a lot of competition. I checked the internet. There looks like there's about 250 or more automobile type magazines. I mean, some are for like hot rods or low riders or, you know, a variety of different categories within the automobile category. But there's a lot of competition. Car and Driver, of course, has some of the highest circulations. And or am I wrong about that? Are you?
Oh, we're the largest in the world.
Oh, okay.
Right. That there's a tremendous amount of activity in this in what they call this publishing vertical. You know, about cars. But I think the reason for that is, you know, we're sort of a men's magazine. You get to men through their passions, through fishing, hunting, cars, sports. And there are very few kind of broadly based men's magazines like Esquire and GQ. The majority of magazines that men read are, you know, about special interest areas, flying, fishing, stuff like that. But there are a ton of them, and the internet has only... made publishing stuff about cars more and more popular, but Car and Driver has retained its, you know, its place at the top through, I think, a pretty careful management of its brand to make sure that we're still doing what we said we'd do, what we, you know, promised our customers we would do, not just in print, but digitally and on, you know, on their smartphones and with events, and you know, the principles of the brand are that we're useful and we're honest and we're fun, and we try to bring the car to life in a really, really special way through a lot of instrumented testing, through great travel stories, through great photography, and above all, great writing.
Yes, yes,
I
particularly value the great writing. Your the subtitle of Car and Driver magazine, which people can see if they look at the very small print under the title on your issues, Intelligence, Independence, Irreverence.
Yeah, so I mean, the intelligence part doesn't mean we're so smart. In fact, you know, our readers are often smarter than we are on a variety of subjects, but the intelligence part is that we have the access to bring you the latest in new car information. And, you know, the independence means that we're not beholden to anybody, and the irreverence is self-explanatory. We try to have as much fun as possible. And now, you know, you said that your second, the job you would
most
like,
fun job,
to, the one that, to the one you have now, is to be a reviewer for Car Magazine, and there's probably not a better time to be doing that than right now, just on the basis of all the incredible cars.
Right, so much, so much going on, such a variety out there. I mean, for people to choose from. And in fact, it's almost extremely frustrating for a lot of people, I think, to if they really say, "Well, I'm really going to look and see what car I really like this year." Whoa, my gosh, there's so many choices,
and there's incredibly crowded.
And there's always something that's going to come out in the next couple of months or the next 6 months if you just wait for it.
You never really stay on top of the product. It's very difficult. And, you know, we're not just dealing with internal combustion engine-powered cars.
No.
Engine cars. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with electric vehicles. We're talking about fuel cells coming online. There's a tremendous amount of variety just in terms of powertrain, in terms of vehicle type and size. We're not just in the coupe, sedan, and sports car world anymore. There's every point along the spectrum on the continuum between a sedan and an SUV. Every hole is filled.
Well, you're not in the irreverence category. You're not quite as irreverent as something like Top Gear magazine. Although I have to say, I was thinking of subscribing just for something different. And although I know it's expensive, I couldn't find that it's for sale in the U.S. anymore. I mean, I just didn't find it in the right place, but not even from their website. They wouldn't allow me to get a subscription from them. I do have a subscription to Car Magazine, Car UK, and that's lovely, and that's expensive, but it's like one of those beautiful things you want to keep every issue around for a long time.
It's a coffee table magazine.
Yes.
I think print
is
moving in that direction. You know, print is kind of the top of the pyramid in terms of cost for us to produce and also for people to spend to buy, but I think it's worth it, and it's permanent, and it's just a very special medium that hasn't been replicated anywhere else yet. There's still, I think, we're still pretty bullish on print because it delivers something that you can't quite get in the free media world.
Oh, absolutely, and I'd love to go back and keep rereading the articles because there's always something I missed, and you know, there's a lot of words there, but I like to savor the opinions. Let me, first of all, because you called exactly when I asked you to at the start of the show, but didn't get a chance to introduce my co-host to our listeners, who is sitting here patiently. His name is John Conroy. He's our WHFR news director. So say hello, John.
Hello, Ed. This is John Conroy. How you doing?
Okay. John's... John's claim to fame here in the last couple months is that he's just over the holiday break, he visited, among many places, he was at CES in Las Vegas, but he also got to the Corvette Museum down in Kentucky and got to look at the big sinkhole there.
Yeah, pretty incredible, right?
Yeah.
Well, very amazing. And the people there just were terrific with all the features of the new Corvettes, et cetera. I also worked for 30 years at GM Powertrain in Ypsilanti.
Oh, great. Well, you know, the links between Car and Driver and Corvette program are pretty strong, and not just the fact that we, you know, do the occasional sneak peek at the mid-engine Corvette or, you know, get the first
if it ever gets here, right.
Our, some of our writers have, our former editor-in-chief who passed a few years ago, he was a Corvette copywriter, and Corvettes have sort of laced through the history of this magazine in an important way.
Yeah, and still so significant today. Although I have to admit, we're going to talk about the auto show, of course, and some other things about the Car and Driver's 10 Best for 2015 in just a moment. But I have to say that it's true that the Corvette is a tremendous accomplishment, even the current model, which is not mid-engine. Although at the auto show, I guess I'll switch right now to the auto show. The auto show people, when I was down there on Tuesday, just talking to people sort of at random, and they seem to all love the new Ford GT. Of course, again, a high-powered supercar. I heard a rumor it's going to be over $200,000, and I think somebody from Ford said they'll probably all be sold before they even get the first one to a dealer. So that's not exactly a real-world car.
No, and, you know, I think that the GT, it's, you know, it exists on a higher plane than your average Mustang or even, you know, even sporty cars like the 350 R that was also there. That's a very, very specialized product. It's a true hypercar or supercar, and it's built really to go racing at Le Mans and to take the fight to the Ferraris the way that Ford did in the 60s.
Yeah, this is 50th anniversary of that victory at Le Mans. And I hate to admit it because it means how very old I am, but in college I spent the summer in France that very summer, and 66, so all this way, and we drove down from northern France, and it's like a 3 or 4 day affair for average people. You have to pull your car into the lot, bumper to bumper, and you can't get out for 3 or 4 days, and you sort of camp out there, one way or the other, or just wander around in a daze, you know.
It is one of the greatest events in motorsport, and it continues to be that way, and it continues to be a proving ground for new technologies. I was just there last year, and I saw in the prototype class, you know, a variety of powertrain solutions from Porsche and Audi and Toyota. And when Ford comes in the GT3 class with this car, the LM class, mm-hmm. which is not the prototype class, mm-hmm. They're going to come with a different technology too. And most current racing formula, the engine is set, and there's not a lot of room to play around. But I think that the greatest technology transfer from racing cars to street cars happens when there's a lot of experimentation in racing.
Well, the last several years, I think in whatever the major or the most watched category of the race is, Audi has been winning with its diesels.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
and this year they had the e-tron, the mm-hmm. electric powertrain. So they're always experimenting. They're trying to prove those technologies in the most challenging environments possible in the 24-hour race like that. You know, I think in the 60s, that race, not that I was around for it, but it used to be more of a, you know, let's conserve the machinery type of race and not an all-out sprint. Mm. Whereas now, it's 24 hours of just wheel-to-wheel, fender-to-fender, incredible racing.
Right. Yeah, it has changed, definitely. When I got there, I didn't even realize, because I'd been in college, maybe I hadn't been reading enough. But so we get there on the opening day, and they're ready to start the race. But before the drivers would, the famous Le Mans start, where the drivers race across the track and then jump in their cars, and then they start racing.
Isn't that incredible? Yeah. That's why Porsches have their ignition keys on the left-hand side of the steering wheel, so that a driver could jump in and with his right hand engage first gear, and with his left hand start the car.
Got a few seconds lead there. So, but who do we see crossing, to be introduced? And Henry Ford II. And we're thinking, we came all the way from southeastern Michigan to see the Le Mans race, and here we get Henry Ford.
In the middle of France.
And then at the end of the race, 1, 2, 3, Ford, you know, just,
incredible.
My God. But, you know, it was very exciting, that race. I remember the Ferrari V12 engines were screaming at the top of their RPMs through the night, trying to keep up with the Fords. Chevy had a Chaparral there. Not Chevy didn't sponsor it, but
what a great year to have been there.
Yeah, Jim Hall had Chaparral, but that had, because that was at that year, it was the only automatic transmission sports car that was racing, and it had transmission troubles of all things about halfway through, so couldn't finish. But it's great, and they don't let you be in the pits, but if you are physically there, you can wander around sort of inside the track and around the track to different vantages. So it's quite a wonderful event for that reason. Well,
yeah, there's a Ferris wheel. It's great.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they didn't have the Ferris wheel when I was there. Darn it! I had to go back, I guess.
I mean, you know, the rivalry started because Henry Ford II wanted to buy Ferrari.
Oh yeah, yeah.
From Enzo Ferrari, but he wouldn't sell, so they went to beat him. And they did.
I understand that that Ferrari's up for sale again, and that maybe Ford is going to make an offer. What do you think? Probably they're not going to now that they got their own
speculation at
GT.
Okay. Yeah, they are. The Fiat group, which owned it, has is in the process of spinning it off for sale.
Right. Yeah. Well. Okay. Back to the real world. The auto show, which I'd rather call the Detroit Auto Show. I mean, I know they changed the name to try to make everybody know that. It's not just for U.S.-made cars. It's for, you know, all manufacturers to show off here. And now you've probably attended the several other large ones, at least New York and L.A. Are they bigger, actually? Do they have more cars? Sometimes the other shows each year have more concept cars introduced.
Well, not necessarily concept cars. Physically, L.A. is a larger facility. Chicago's at McCormick Place, a larger facility. But in terms of kind of wattage, the Detroit show really brings them in. And you know, what you said there about it being an international show, but we just call it Detroit, I think that's spot on, because this year was a great example of how Detroit really dominates their home show. And you saw a wide range of concept and production cars from not so much FCA, but General Motors and Ford. Ford, obviously, the GT we talked about, that was the pinnacle, and that was really the standout of the show, and that surprised everybody. But they also had a really, really powerful track-oriented Mustang. They had a new Raptor there, and they had, you know, a full line of cars that you could actually buy.
Mm-hmm.
General Motors had some really incredible stuff as well, including the Bolt EV, which kind of breaks the paradigm for small EVs.
Right, the concept car that's all electric, but won't be out for a couple of years, and they might change the name, right?
Yeah, and you know, those small electric cars that are in the $40,000 range, they all have a functional range of about 75 miles on a charge.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about the Bolt is that it almost triples that at the same price point.
Yeah.
And a lot of those cars are, you know, sort of government-mandated affairs by the state of California with their zero-emissions vehicle mandate. And the infrastructure is not quite there to support, you know, a huge fleet of cars. And I don't even know if, personally speaking, it would be so great for the environment if everybody's running electric vehicles, because let's face it, half of these cars are coal-powered when you get right down to
half
it.
Half of the electric generating electric facilities, right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
generate electricity with coal in the United States.
It's probably going to phase in with the technology, but most people that I talk to, too, seem to say that 200 miles per charge is sort of the point where they might consider an electric car. I know for around town here, since I live in Dearborn, the Detroit area, I like to go to Ann Arbor every now and then. That's where, by the way, Car and Driver headquarters are based.
Got to stop by.
Well, maybe I should. Still, it, you know, that's 45 miles approximately each way. Well, maybe a little bit less, 40. And you know, I'd like to have a little extra range there on the charge, just to make sure that maybe I could do a side trip, or, you know.
You can't do a round trip in a Nissan Leaf, right?
Not really, yeah.
And even when you're driving a Tesla, you're still worried. You still have a little range anxiety. You still
sure.
What happens if this predicted range, because I'm using the heater, and I'm using the radio, and I'm using all this other stuff, what if that... you know, what if that's overly ambitious?
Right. Well,
so
I know.
It's a little,
yeah.
You want to be stranded.
Exactly. I did drive a Leaf 2 years ago. The salesperson didn't go out with me. So I got on an I-96 here and brought it up to like 85 miles an hour just to see if it would be, you know, a good handling car. And it was very flat. It was very peppy. Of course, by the time I got back a half an hour later, I hardly had any charge left. Of course, it burns off the electricity when you're going a little bit faster, too. I don't know if it's the resistance from the wind or what it is, but it was great. But I was going to mention that the Leaf and, of course, the Tesla and these other electric cars, they usually come with apps for your smartphones now to tell you where various charging stations are. Even 2 years ago, the Leaf had an app, but the problem is not every charging station has the right kind of charging cable or adapter plug. And I think that's terrible.
These are early days for this technology.
Apparently,
we'll see what happens as it gets built out. There was just an announcement yesterday that BMW and I believe it was Mercedes-Benz.
Maybe, yeah.
Are partnering with ChargePoint on the coast to mm-hmm. put rapid charging stations up and down.
Well.
You know, the West Coast and the East Coast, right. Which should help. But this is,
sure.
I mean, we're in the process of building out these.
Well, rapid charging stations are really helpful because you can, 15, 20 minutes, maybe just a little more than a gas station stop or something. Because if you needed a full charge with, it would take maybe overnight, 6 to 8 hours in the regular 110 outlets. But I think the problem for me, too, is that, there's not a standardization, that some of the charging points, they won't fit your car, that the charger for the Leaf is not the same charger, rapid or not, for the Ford Focus.
Yeah, and, there are adapters that the cars come with, but that's true of the Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
The Leaf, the 5-point 240 charger, that's fairly standardized, and you have that in the Volt as well. But it is,
These are
early days for the technology, and it's still somewhat experimental, and it still requires an early adopter mindset.
Well, getting back to the auto show, I thought some interesting exhibits. Well, I love seeing the U of M solar-powered car. That was in the downstairs sort of showroom.
Oh, I did not see that.
Yeah, apparently they came in.
I've been following that program for a bit.
They have a race every year. It was in Dubai this year or sometime last year, and they came in second, though, to some other car. But it's basically just a very flat top surface, except for where they got the driver that can peer over all these solar panels. And it's great. U of M right here in Michigan. The 3D printed car was down
local
there.
Local Motors. Yeah, that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, some people called it Loco Motors.
Yeah.
I couldn't find the car. And I said, where's the car? I was at the exhibit. He said, where's the car? I said, well, it's out being charged up. He said, but we're printing another one right now. I'm thinking, whoa, wait a minute. What? Can you explain that to our listeners better than maybe I could? How do you print a car?
Well, you do it in layers.
Okay, and it's plastic.
The 3D printing is going to be, I think, transformative for the industry because you'll be able to put the material where it's needed, and the tooling will be completely different. It's a completely different economy than we're talking about with the traditional plant. But again, we're well far off. If you took a look at that Local Motors car, you'd see just how sort of ridiculous it looked and how not ready for prime time it looked. I don't know if you remember that Saturday Night Live fake commercial about the Adobe car that was made out of clay.
When
you crashed it, you could just replace the clay.
Yeah,
it looked a little bit like that.
Just wet some sand and pack it in there.
You gotta start somewhere. You have to start somewhere, and
sure.
I think the Local Motors thing is interesting all the way around because it's crowdsourced. It's, taking the best ideas that the web has to offer and applying it to
but you can't print
automotive advancement.
Yeah, I can understand printing the body and maybe the seats and that, but you can't print the tires, right?
No, you can't print.
Not yet, anyway. And
one step at a time.
And the motor, that's in this case, I guess, since he said it was charged up, that's an electric motor and batteries. So
right.
Okay. Well, I just thought it was interesting. Too bad I couldn't see it. I don't know why they had to take it away to charge it. They couldn't afford an outlet there in the booth, I guess. It was a low-power thing. A couple of crazy things down there. Ford, they had their display right next to, of course, the Lincoln Motor Car Company. But they put a sort of a curtain between the two. You could see through it. But, they were side by side. But they had to have a curtain just to let people know there's a difference, I guess. I thought that was.
I guess so.
And then Ford put a forest in there. They put a forest of a bunch of Norfolk Island pine trees, some of them 10, 12 feet high. I guess that was just, I don't know, cool.
Very, very environmentally conscious, right?
Yeah, I'm sure. I have to say that the auto show the last 10 years, it's kind of unsafe for senior citizens that might have a mobility problem in terms of walking. In a wheelchair or a powered scooter, you're okay because they have a lot of sloping platforms, and a few of them are marked.
Not just senior citizens. I've seen young people do headers over these.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's steps, too, at places, and sometimes they got a little sign, watch your step, but it really is somewhat of a hazard to do it that way. I just rather would have nothing but steps, you know, so you'd always look for the step or something. But
that's a good public service announcement. So anybody going to the show this weekend, make sure you bring, you know, keep your eyes peeled.
Right. The Detroit Auto Show, folks, is still open till 10 o'clock tonight and 9 to 10 tomorrow and Sunday 9 to 7 p.m. only, but it's the last weekend for that. Well, I have some crazy categories here. Most swoopy car, and I'm talking about sleek lines, and I don't mean the Ford GT or the Corvette here because, to me, those are sort of harsh lines. You know, they're like the big cutouts and harsh angles, extreme angles, and that's kind of the style these days for a lot of the cars. But in turn, my most swoopy category was a couple of the Maseratis that I saw there. Probably one is a new model, which was the sleekest I've ever seen, and I don't know what it was, but it was
the Alfieri.
Oh yes, that's it.
Named after one of the Maserati brothers. Beautiful coupe, and it was shown at the Geneva show. I saw it for the first time last March.
Yeah.
At the Geneva show, and it's just spectacular looking.
Well, yeah, and to each their own for style, of course. Car and Driver probably was happy to see the somewhat small one car display of a manual transmission car, the Jaguar F. I guess it was a convertible there, but they're claiming that they now have a manual transmission available in at least their lower end V6 models for the Jaguar F. Is that a trend? Are manuals on their way back?
I don't think so.
No.
But I think they're important for sports cars, and they're important for kind of brand messaging. You know, the F-Type is an important car for Jaguar, not for the amount of sales it generates, although it's a great selling car in the UK and in Europe, less so here. But it's a real carrier of that brand's ethos and what they hope to be. And you know, with an F-Type in the lineup, it's kind of like a modern-day E-Type. It, to me, you look at the rest of their lineup, like the XF and XJ sedans and now the coming SUV, and it sort of makes a lot more sense when you have an F-Type sort of holding the center, sort of the way that the Porsche 911 allows Porsche to do a Panamera and a Cayenne and a Macan with a straight face because, you know, this is a sporting company and the essence of the 911 is shared among those other vehicles. I think that the F-Type is a pretty landmark product for Jag, and having a manual transmission in that car really says that they're committed to performance.
Right. It's just great that they had like the sign on the top of the windshield, and they're making a big deal, at least for that car. In fact, the two side doors to that car had a manual transmission gear shift pattern on it, just to show you know this. Hey, this is where the gears are, folks. In case you never shifted before, you know, first
that's
is up
those,
and
those skills that could evaporate. And you know, about 4 years ago, we were putting together our, four and a half years ago, new cars issue. And I looked through, and all the new Ferraris, none of them had a manual transmission.
Right, yeah.
And Ferrari was famous for its manual transmissions. They had this beautiful polished aluminum gate, and the like with a polished aluminum ball on top of the shift knob, and it made this great sound clicking into the gears. And they had abandoned it because it wasn't as fast on a track.
Yeah.
Their customers found it clunky and hard to use, and you know, it took a lot of skill to do it right and to do rev match downshifts and stuff like that, but it's just depressing to us. So we started this campaign called Save the Manuals, and we've been encouraging automakers to use that language and to bring the manual back to keep that skill alive, because once it vanishes from cars, the next generation of people, even if they might not even be driving.
And this is for the internal combustion engine cars that really do need that the shifting of ratios in order to have adequate power and also economy, no matter what speed you're going. So a different.
Well, that's changed quite a bit, actually.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be that the manual transmission was far more economical than an automatic.
Right.
But now you have these 8,
yeah.
9, and 10-speed transmissions with a big ratio spread. Well, they're always in the right gear, and so that's not 100% true, but I will tell you that if you want your kids to not text and drive, get them a car with the manual.
Exactly. I have to say, personal feeling here, I've had about 20-some cars that I've owned. Every 3 or 4 years, I get another car just to try it out. I currently have a 2014 Mini Cooper S convertible with a six-speed, and I love it because not only the manual, I think it makes me a sharper driver because I have to concentrate more on driving and when I'm shifting. But also, even in this bad weather, I feel I can control the wheel spin on difficult surfaces by staying in a certain gear, as long as I need to, or shifting to a higher gear. I just still think that my internal computer, after years of experience, is still better than most anything else out there. That I don't.
It just gives you a much greater degree of control.
I was going to say control,
for a lot of people, that's really important. For me, it is.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think John was saying here, too, I had his mic down a little, that control is the issue for all of us. There are times when, in like Michigan winters, that you might want to turn off the stability control or anti-traction, depending of, I was reading the other day that, you've got a Corvette or something, you might want to turn off the traction control if you want to actually spin the wheels as much as possible to maybe get you unstuck.
That's true.
The rocking back and forth thing where you just spin as much as you can. Yeah.
That's exactly right. And sometimes if it's a really snowy day and you see this beautiful unplowed parking lot and you're in like a rear drive car like a Corvette, sometimes you want to go into that parking lot and do donuts for about 30 minutes. And use up all the gas.
I'd like you to explain that. If you've got a few more minutes, we'll continue. I won't keep you the full hour, but this is very exciting, at least to me anyway. Folks, this is the new WHFR Journal, WHFR.fm, the station making waves from Henry Ford College, and our special guest today by phone from all the way from Ann Arbor, Michigan, I assume, or maybe from your home if you're able to do some work at home. It's Eddie Alderman, the editor-in-chief of Car and Driver Magazine. As he says, the number one car magazine, car enthusiast magazine in the world, and rightly so, I think. In fact, I always give my daughter my subscription copy every month when I'm done with it, because she's a teacher in Southfield Public Schools, and she drives a Chrysler minivan from a couple years ago, and she believes she hates driving. She just hates driving. If I could only get her...
We'll try to change that.
Well, if I could only get her to read your magazine a little bit more, and before she has to buy another car, look down your 10 best list. Talk about Car and Driver's 2015 10 Best. That was in your November issue.
Yeah, no, that was in January.
Oh, it was January issue?
We...
I've got the February issue in front of me. That's the reason, yes. Okay, the last issue.
This was in January, uh-huh. And... 10 best, we want to keep it contained to cars that are actually attainable. You know, the thinking of that is that, you know, if a car is $100,000, $200,000, it's pretty easy to make it incredible.
Yeah.
You can throw all the technology and materials and high test powertrains at it and get a great, great car. But to actually build a car for, a wider mass of people, that has to have a greater bandwidth and wider range of functions, that's tough. And, we're proud that this list contains cars that are under $25,000 to start with, like the Mazda 3, the Mazda 6, the Honda Accord, the Volkswagen Golf. It's just a tremendous amount of virtue in these hot, very, very hotly contested, very competitive segments.
Yep.
Those are crucibles.
Yeah.
The mid-sized sedan segment has produced some incredible cars that do so many things well.
Well, that's why I always recommend your best 10 best car list to people to look at if they're considering a car, especially if they don't like cars or don't like driving, because maybe this would excite them a little bit if they would just look at... And again, I, in fact, you mentioned Mazda 3. I went to a Mazda dealer last year and drove a number of Mazdas. I couldn't quite fit in the Miata. I'm 6'1", but... And besides, I knew there was a new model coming out, so why get stuck with the old one? But anyway, the Mazda 3, it's a great little hatchback. Of course, I love hatchback designs, but it's got a peppy engine, and it's just a, zoom, zoom, as they say. But the Mazda 6
really
is very nice. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it drives great. It has this great ergonomic package where everything is very easy to use. It's just entertaining at all speeds. It's just a highly engaging car that you don't have to spend a ton of money to get. And that's what we're looking to reward. You know, the cars that really fulfill their missions well, the cars that are engaging to drive, and the cars that really deliver value. So that's what this list is. It's not, you know, oh my God, Ferraris, Lamborghinis, and Range Rovers. It's Accords, Mazdas, and Volkswagens for the most part. But, you know, we do have some fun cars in there. We have obviously the Corvette.
Yeah.
The
Porsche Boxster Cayman.
Yeah, the Porsche Boxster Cayman, which are really, they just sneak in right under our $80,000 price cap.
Right.
But I would challenge you to find a Boxster or a Cayman S on the on your dealer's lot that's under $80,000, which is a tragedy. The cars are just loaded up with these super expensive options, but the core product, the core engineering on that car is just spectacular. Yeah.
I actually had in my history of I think 20 some cars that I bought, I actually bought well, if you call the Mini a BMW, since it's by their parent company, I've owned seven BMWs, but I've always had to, on the ones that were actually BMW cars, literally the small sedans. I had a Z3 one year, and I got always the least equipment I could get, and I had to special order them. But at least BMW would allow me to do that, you know, right from Germany or wherever. Porsche will do that too, but yeah.
Hard to go into a Porsche dealer and go on a lot and find a car that's completely stripped down to its essence.
Right. Yeah. So I, you know, just as a teacher in college, I wasn't making, I'm still not making, especially retired, I'm not making hardly enough to buy anything. But in fact, I bought the Mini Cooper S after saving for like 5 years and decided, well, this might be the last car. And boy, I have to say, and I'm sorry to see it's not in a lot of lists, but it is such a fun car. I have, of course, I like, you know, the direct steering, not the electronic steering or whatever.
The people who love the Mini, and they're really bonded to those cars. It's rare to find vehicles that have their own unique point of view,
right?
Especially at a lower price point. I mean, yeah, you can have nothing quite feels like a Range Rover or a Rolls-Royce or whatever,
right.
But, you know, at $25,000, $30,000, it's rare to get that level of personality.
Well, and I like the fun of a spirited engine in a front wheel drive. Even I know BMW might be going front wheel drive with their own sedans in a couple of years, but I guess it was because I had fun for a couple of years with one of my former wives bought a brand new Ford Probe GT, and that was
one of your former wives.
Well, there's only two.
Okay.
So let's not go crazy here. Not like my 20 cars. I didn't have 20 wives, but she wanted, you know, a sporty car, and she got a great deal. And it was one of the first ones that were sold. I can't remember which year, but the Ford was thinking like maybe this will be the next generation of Mustangs, but they still had the Mustang, and people didn't like the initial styling of the Probe GT, but it did have that really torquey front wheel drive, and of course front wheel drive steer, which if you accelerate a little bit around the corner and the steering wheel practically flew out of your hands, you know,
touching your hands a little bit.
Yeah, but I just have to, I, you know, I'm really used to that, and I love it in Michigan winters. I've had some four wheel drive cars. I had I had to lease it to afford it, a BMW X5 diesel 3 years ago. And, you know, four-wheel drive, wonderful, no problem. But front-wheel drive is, I think, better than rear-wheel drive, unless you have great snow tires on. And I just, you know, just...
It's about the tires. Yeah. That's the key
but
thing.
Talk about entertaining the so-called go-kart steering. This is not a commercial for Minis necessarily here, but that really direct feel. I drove a Volt when it first came out, and I thought I was in a video game, you know, like, you know, no feeling of the road at all.
And that's getting pretty prevalent in a lot of cars as they switch from hydraulic steering systems to electric power systems.
I think maybe the BMW
road feel coming through.
Does the BMW 2 still have mechanical steering? I know for a while it did when it was a BMW 1. I'm not sure if the M235i, which is on your 10 best list, has gone to electronic now. But
you know, I think it's still hydraulic.
Yeah, it was the last holdout in the BMW line.
It felt very much like hydraulic.
Yeah. Well, just a couple of quick questions, a little bit off the 10 best or the auto show question, but your car and driver does things about the auto industry too, and there was two articles in the last couple months about auto insurance issues too. I mean, the situation, especially in the Detroit area, is just terrible in terms of cost for people. My daughter was living in Dearborn, and then she, two years ago, moved to Allen Park. And with the same insurance company, her rates went down 40%. And that's just, it's unbelievable. It's terrible how the rates are handled here in Michigan. And then your magazine commented about how Progressive Insurance is trying to get people and even or maybe car companies into the habit of putting these little devices that record your driving techniques or speeds or whatever. I'm not sure what they're looking for. And
we're not real fans of that.
No.
You know, one of the big thrusts of our editorial position is that obviously we're very pro-car, we're very pro-technology, but we're also very pro-driver's rights. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those areas where, yeah, the technology is cool and everything, but think about all the privacy you're giving up. You're giving somebody access to your driving habits. They'll be able to figure out very shortly where you go. They see certainly how fast you go. They see, and I don't want to sound paranoid, but I just think that privacy is dwindling in every aspect of life.
Well,
and the car, you know, sacrosanct for so long as a private space. Now we're inviting people into the car, and it's not just with Progressive Insurance putting mm-hmm. that little snapshot in there
yep.
that supposedly gets you a better rate. It's also with, you know, Google and Apple coming into the car and tracking your movements and, you know,
oh, sure, all the various GPS
data
and nav
most,
services.
Most valuable yep. data is the most valuable thing in the world right now. We've gone from, you know, a 20th century economy where, you know, that was mechanically based, and it was built around the car, and the car was the most, the car or the airplane were the most important social revolutions
mm-hmm.
Around machines in that century. Now we are in a different era, and high-speed data is kind of the defining technology of this century so far.
Yeah, I would say you're not paranoid if they are out to get you.
That's
and,
exactly
and,
right.
And definitely for the sake of profit, at least that's excuse, or in the case of the government, for the sake of, I don't know, protect you from your own fears, you know, they are out to get you. They are out to monitor you constantly, and some people are willing to give that up. Of course, yours truly is not. Remember, folks, all the opinions on this show are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford College.
But it's hard not to look at it and say, yeah. Wow, we're really giving up a lot of control.
Yeah.
And we're really giving up a lot of independence and with it personal responsibility. And I don't want to sound political,
no,
but you look at the trend and it really is, it's kind of staggering.
So the auto insurance issue in terms of the cost here, is that all politics? I mean, that has to be resolved by laws passed in our legislature to change things since we're
very,
some...
Very complicated.
Yeah, very complicated.
Very
okay.
It's
well, keep trying to cover that.
Have any visibility into it.
Yeah, keep trying to cover that in Car and Driver because that's it really affects the kind of car you can afford to buy, too, you know,
that's
the
right.
insurance you have to pay.
Part of the cost.
What about the auto dealer issue? Franchise or direct from factory? Obviously, that's political, too. I know Elon Musk was at giving a press conference last week at the auto show area, and he was saying that maybe he might consider franchising just to get into some of these states that have said he can't do direct sales.
Yeah. They've been tightening up those laws. You know, his position was that the franchise laws that are state by state, but basically say that the company can't compete with the little dealer because their advantages are too great. Those franchise laws really protect the small business person and from the competition of the factory.
Mm-hmm.
So Musk's position has been, well, those franchise laws don't apply to me because I have no dealers.
Oh.
Therefore, I'm not competing with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not
yeah.
disadvantaging anybody. I'm going direct to the consumer, which is,
yeah.
incidentally, exactly what the consumer wants.
Yeah,
and they've shown it.
The example, John and I were talking before the show about the example of Saturn, at least being a pay-one-price sort of situation when GM had that car going. And customer satisfaction was always huge for the
yeah.
Saturn because of the sort of no-haggle, pay-one-price policy. And we... John was suggesting to me that maybe it was just jealousy on the part of either other divisions of GM or other car companies. That
there's some truth to that. I think that
Saturn wasn't a great car necessarily, but.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, John. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, it's Jay.
It's Jay.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. No. But, go ahead.
I thought that there was some truth to that. That people at Oldsmobile said, "Why is this upstart division Saturn getting all this special treatment and getting billions of dollars to develop their own vehicles and whatever happened to us?" And I think there was some internal strife.
Mm-hmm. Well, because in all of my car buying experiences, I often buy a car because of the great salespeople, and they're nice to you, they're intelligent. Of course, I'm expecting intelligence. I'm expecting people to be able to talk to me rationally about the cars. Once they know that I know so much, I would like them to respect me.
It's a very sophisticated sale, and the best dealers have tremendous loyalty, and people buy cars from the dealers they like as much as they buy the cars they like. And so I think there are two sides of this issue, and it would be unfair to say that everybody hates dealers. A lot of people love dealers,
right,
and they're friends with their dealer.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly there is also this I want it now kind of instantaneous, deliver it to my house kind of thing that we're being trained to expect through Amazon and Zappos other retail outlets like that. Most people will tell you that they don't even care to test drive a car anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's they don't understand, I'm afraid.
They don't.
Yeah. And in fact, even though you can read a lot of great reviews in a variety of magazines, including Car and Driver, of course, you really have to drive the car yourself. I made a very bad mistake a couple years ago. I actually bought a Jeep Wrangler, but I only took a test drive against my own better judgment around town. I didn't take it on the expressway. Oh my gosh. After I got it, I only had it for 3 months and I had to get rid of it because it was jiggly, it was bouncy. Of course, when you're used to BMWs and other good cars at speed, it's just not satisfactory. It was driving me crazy. So
it's a whole different animal.
Yeah, but you have to drive it in the situation where you want to drive it in. You have to take a test drive that's going to be on the same sort of roads or the same speeds. I always do at least and I warn the dealer, if the salesperson, if they're with me, I want to do it like a tight figure eight in somebody's back lot. Just maybe only 15 miles an hour, but I want to go full left, full right, see how much it leans, and see if there's any strange noises or burning smells, coming up. And it's that's one of my little tests, and many cars fail that. A couple of Mercedes-Benz failed that for me in past years. They weren't the top-of-the-line sporty AMG Mercedes-Benz, mind you, but they're just too soft and mushy, and I just didn't like. So, yeah, it's hard to believe, but I understand some people just want the basic transportation. They want a good deal. They're willing to take what's over on the lot, which means you probably have to take something that's got accessories they don't want.
Sure, but it's like anything. The more research you do, the more involved you are in a purchase, especially one of that magnitude, the better off you are and the better product you get.
Mm-hmm.
You would just end up with a better result.
Any hope for other alternative energy cars? I see that some manufacturers got a hydrogen or fuel cell car. They're going to try to get on the road at least for some testing anyway with real people.
Hydrogen is the holy grail.
Yeah,
hydrogen
next year.
Hydrogen is the holy grail because, as we were discussing earlier, it doesn't have the long recharge time.
Mm-hmm.
There is no emission associated with its tailpipe. It just puts out water vapor. There are emissions further upstream, and a lot of the so-called well-to-wheel analysis still have battery electric vehicles as greener than hydrogen, but that could change.
Mm-hmm.
And hydrogen's pretty exciting. I mean, these are essentially both electric vehicles, but one just gets its power from a battery and one through a fuel cell, through electrolysis and a fuel cell.
Right. And so where does hydrogen come from? They make it from what?
It's everywhere.
Take it out of the air, like H2O.
They reform it.
Water.
They reform it from a lot of different sources.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll see where that goes. I want to thank you for being with us today in the Journal, giving us all your opinions and the update about Car and Driver. I guess crazy question for me at the end. Going to test any more three-wheel cars? I know they're not quite cars.
Yeah.
I mean, their license is motorcycles, but...
The next issue in March 2015, which I just got an advanced copy of, we have a test of the Polaris Slingshot.
Slingshot, yeah. Uh-huh.
Pretty
and
cool.
What about the Elio? I mean, they're not, they don't have anything you can buy yet, but the Elio Motors has a three-wheel
more
car.
More of a three-wheel golf cart.
Okay.
A real kind of. I
noticed
like a
that
Morgan three-wheeler.
John saw it here at the CES show, which was interesting. I guess because even though it's got minimal engine and they say 85 miles to a gallon and so on, but it supposedly sells at least the basic model for $6,500 if they can ever get to sell it. They haven't got their factory together yet.
Right.
But they had it at CES because they came up with a huge navigation nav system, which seems very strange or incompatible with such a bare bones basic kind of transportation, but I assume that's what they were showing off there. I'm not sure you covered that, but the Polaris seems like fun, and of course these three-wheel cars can get around some of the safety regulations, whether they're valuable or not, because they're licensed apparently as motorcycles.
Depending, yeah. I mean, and it goes state by state.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, the manufacturers certainly want them categorized as motorcycles rather than cars.
Well, finally, let me just ask you to comment about your editorial from the current issue about cars having souls. Somebody said to you that German luxury cars are passionless. And
hearing that a lot.
I don't.
They're passionless.
Well, I know the BMWs keep getting bigger and more expensive, and they're out of my category now, except for, you know, the maybe the smallest size, like the X1 or the 2 Series. But you had an interesting conclusion about that, if you remember it.
You know, they say that German cars are lacking in passion. I think it's exactly the opposite. German cars are the most mercenary and competitive, and, you know, their passions are warlike passions. These are not like Alfa Romeo, La Dolce Vita, you know, wanting to sit around a lounge all day. These are like, I mean, these guys build cars. One of the chairman of VW said, "We race because there is no war." That's their mentality.
Wow.
You know,
yeah,
so it's far from passionless and it's far from soulless.
Right.
These guys are animated by this the most competitive spirit you can imagine, and that's why their cars are so dominant. And it goes back pre-war and the immediate post-war era.
Yeah.
And you know a lot of the base technologies that we're still playing with are World War II aeronautical technologies, space frames and direct injection and stuff like that. You know, these guys, it's absolutely unfair to call them soulless and passionate. Cold and calculating and dominant, yes, but not passionless, not soulless. These guys want to win.
If I might quote you from your own editorial, he says, Eddie Alderman here says, "Let me see if I understand the argument. Their inanimate objects are now too inanimate."
Right.
They're too inanimate. He says, whereas...
I mean, we're talking about cars, right? We're not talking about, you know...
You said you don't want another animal living in your garage.
I don't. I had a raccoon in there.
Yeah, right.
A live trap.
I was going to say, I did last year, too. Oh, my gosh. Seriously, that's what a love of cars or enthusiasm of cars, which not only serve a very important function. I hope we never get to autonomous cars. Why not just have, you know, more mass transit? If people don't want to drive... We should have good mass transit. Driving, I hope, in the future, whatever the power sources, will be full of soul and spirit and excitement. Maybe people only do it on weekends, or if they're brave enough, every day. It'll cost a little more. It will not be so inexpensive, let's say, as mass transit might be. But it really adds something to your experience of life. Again, if you haven't read Car and Driver much, folks, or the other great enthusiast magazines out there, or tried to drive some of these vehicles, even some that are quite reasonable, you won't understand, I guess. But
the car really is that pathway to adventure and to self-discovery. It's still that way. It's still the thing that you get in, you turn on, and you drive wherever you want, whenever you want. You don't have to tell anybody about it.
I think my colleague here, John Conroy, is going to get the final word. Quick, John, we're going to let him go.
Yes, and I want to echo your comment about privacy in the vehicle, driving across the fields or the streets in Kansas and through the highways and byways, if you're from Arizona to Nashville. You felt great to have that kind of control and kind of shut down all the noise around you.
That's what the car does.
Yeah, it was great.
So,
and on a one real quick lighter note, car and driver being headquartered in Ann Arbor, when we come to visit you, can we go to Zingerman's?
Hey, I get that question a lot. I'm kind of Zingerman's out. But, yeah, we can go.
Okay, very good.
We'll see about that. Right. Although if we come, Eddie, don't worry. We'll treat. Don't worry. We can,
okay.
We can afford that place, I think.
All right.
Thank you so much for the great extended interview today. Of course, folks, this is available as a podcast from our website right after broadcast, so you can listen over and over and take notes on the great cars at the auto show and those that weren't at the auto show. And keep doing the great job out there with Car and Driver, Eddie.
Thanks so much, guys. Thanks, Jay and John.
Thanks very much for being with us. Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, well, we're still here for a couple more minutes. Highway 61 with Joanne Kay is coming up at 2 o'clock from 2 to 6 p.m., the best in the blues. WHFR.FM, the station making ways. WHFR Dearborn. Just a few quick other stories here that I wanted to update you on in terms of local news about literally Dearborn Heights. First of all, we talked last week about the school district called D7 out there in Dearborn Heights, although I'm always confused whether it's really part of Dearborn Heights. Apparently has seven different school districts. I don't know why, but nonetheless, the D7 district, their superintendent, who was hired last summer, took leave in November. And then we mentioned last week there was a secret meeting in December that nobody could, of the Board of Ed. And now we just mentioned in the Dearborn Press and Guide on their website this morning that their superintendent is going to quit on January 20th. So apparently he was either encouraged or they just felt they couldn't keep him in office, even on leave, any longer, that they needed a person full time. The reasons were, according to the article, both health and personal reasons, and that was it. And they will appoint an interim superintendent. Right now they have the associate superintendent, the number two superintendent that they had there doing the superintendent's job, and I guess it's maybe more money to become interim superintendent, and then they will decide to go do a search for a full-time superintendent there. So that issue with that status now. Also, Judge Summers, our 19th district, one of our 19th district court judges here, another ruling in the case that he inappropriately fired an employee from the court's administrative office years ago now. I don't know, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years ago. And that person has gone on to be now the wife of Judge Hultgren, also of the 19th District Court. The latest big ruling has said that both Summers and Dearborn must pay what is now about $1.5 million because there's interest apparently on the original award. I guess the longer you appeal, the more the interest builds up. So the question still is, because the city of Dearborn is, and it didn't say in the article, but in the heading of the Times Herald, it said that the city is appealing. So, first of all, they don't want to have to pay. They've been saying, well, he's not our employee. Well, yeah, but you pay for the administration of the district court. That's what Dearborn does. And you tell that administrator how to do his or her job. In this case, it's been his for a while. Summers is not currently that administrator at this point, but Judge Salami is currently serving. But who appoints that justice to be the chief administrator. The state of Michigan does. One of their judicial bodies does that appointment. So in a way, he works for the state. Of course, the ruling from this judge has said, the state's not going to pay. even though he was technically paid by, therefore, I think, the employee of the state of Michigan in that tenure. But the office itself and all the budget for the administration of the 19th District Court comes from the city of Dearborn. And in fact, very, very many times I know that the city council has told the administrative judge, we want you to increase the fines. We want you to save money in the administration of that court. And of course, Summer says, that's what I was doing. I said, one person, this particular job that this person was in who sued, doesn't have to be there. We don't need it. So he thought he was saving money, but because there are some other issues involved here, I'm not going to go over that. Actually, the Times Herald this week in their story from just 2 days ago, Wednesday edition, went into the whole backlog. It was from page one and continued on page two. So the whole backlog of this very unfortunate situation is there. But now there's a question of, I guess, not the state, but, well, unless the city's appeal goes through, who's going to have to pay that money is still up in the air. But definitely they can't dismiss the whole thing. Somebody's going to have to pay, it looks like, at this point. So there you go. That's our update on those couple of local issues. Next week we'll have more exciting local issues and exciting people to talk to, we hope. John and I will return at that time.
I won't be here.
Oh, John's not going to be here.
I won't be here. I'll be on the road again.
He's going out on the road again. Well,
but I'm going east this time. Not
okay.
South.
Well, give us your road report then.
I'll definitely do that.
Like we heard about Kentucky today. We heard about Las Vegas and the CES. So and what the roads are like between Arizona and Kentucky. And
Kentucky roads are great.
That's right. Yeah, we're going to give people the road reports here on the show because. Every now and then, hard to believe, you might want to get out of Dearborn. You know, it's hard to believe. But, and I hope you're doing it in a great car. Maybe you can get down to the auto show. It is a lot of fun. I can't endorse anything in particular, but I will say that there is a restaurant in Detroit, and it would be a commercial if I mentioned their name, but they have free complimentary shuttle to the auto show down and back. And you just have to park your car. There's a parking charge at the restaurant, but then they will take you down. There's a schedule. You do have to make a reservation so that either before or after the shuttle, you eat at that restaurant. But in the long run, it was cheaper. Well, it was the same cost for me to get this nice meal and the shuttle as if I would have parked at a parking garage near Cobo Center, which is $20. Also, if you're a senior, that is 65 or above, or a child, 12 or below, you get a discount price, which I thought was nice of them, and it's about half price. So, and I'm not suggesting you lie here, but they didn't want to see my ID to prove I was a senior over 65. And I took that as an insult. We won't look at your ID here at the ticket office, but maybe they want to see it at the door. And they say, but maybe they're too busy at the door, you know, when they take your ticket. So